All right, ladies and gentlemen, joining me on today's episode of the Rice Crypto Show is the mysterious Mr. A from the Crypto Vigilante. He is a crypto market technician. He's a former network and security consultant, miner, investor, and trader since 2012. He's an early Monero and pirate chain adopter. He has a university degree in molecular biology, certifications in IT, security, networks, and audio engineering. He's an accomplished music producer and DJ. He's played large music festivals. He does charting and analyzing for Bitcoin, and he's been doing that for over a decade. Pure technical analysis, never financial advice. Mr. A, thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, man. So this is officially the first interview or anything that you've done outside of the Crypto Vigilante. There was a public interview that you did with Rafael Laverde, who I interviewed recently, and I'll link that down below. But most of the stuff you do is kind of behind the scenes for the members of the Crypto Vigilante. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I did one interview with Rafael when I joined TCV, and that was posted on CryptoVigilante.tv for the members to watch, but it's public, so anyone could have watched that one. We talked a little bit about the history, but as far as a public interview goes, this is my first one ever. I'm kind of slightly coming out of my closet today and my into the little bit more public eye, but well, still maintaining a level of privacy.
And you're definitely getting the privacy. That's why I say in the mysterious Mr. A. And just so people know, I couldn't crack this egg. I couldn't get anything to figure out who this guy is. I have no clue, but I'm going to respect his privacy. I appreciate him taking the time to do this because I want to get to know you a little bit, Mr. A, and then I want to kind of get into what you do with some of your charting and then explore some different areas of cryptocurrency, maybe talk about Satoshi Nakamoto. For people who might be unfamiliar with you, do you mind kind of giving a little background on who Mr. A is without doxing yourself in any capacity?
So what we can talk about is, I think that's something that Rafael has already mentioned on the last video, is that Mr. W and I go way back. And we go back to the old Bull Bear Analytics days. And we were some of the very earliest people to chart and analyze Bitcoin. I was personally on the Bitcoin Talk forums very early on. I was probably one of the few people who have watched, Satoshi post on the forums in real time. So that gave me an understanding of like, what's the vibe behind the writings of this person who created this and his perspective on things, and that was, almost a decade ago, over a decade ago now, I think. So when people talk about Satoshi today, it's a very different perspective. They didn't get to watch it happen. I mean, people who watched it happen probably feel a little different than people who are just talking about, this or that possibility. So that's how far back I go. Since then, I essentially, I was mining Bitcoin early on. And then when the ASICs were first released into the world, I figure out that, they'll probably be the last chance for the home miners to do things at home. So I got into the ASIC wave early on. And when they became prohibitively expensive to mine at home to making sort of like major profits, that's when I stopped. But at the same time that I was slowing the mining down, I was getting into the charting and analysis. So I flipped into from the miner into a trader, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
That's very cool, man. It's a really cool story, and it's kind of interesting that you were able to be a part of these early conversations and witness the postings in real time of Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, I definitely wasn't one of those individuals, but I would feel very fortunate to even just have that opportunity just to go back in time and experience that, knowing the kind of impact that Bitcoin has made today, which is, I think, one of the most revolutionary technologies that have come out, almost like a gift, like a gift from God.
There is a presentation I did at the TCV Summit. And it's entitled Bitcoin, the Medicine. And when you say it's a gift from God, it's most definitely the medicine to actually fix this world. And in that presentation, I go into the many things that it does to actually fix all the problems, being just, you know, money, and how it can help the world, and bring balance, and also bring honesty to all levels of many, many things.
We definitely need more of that. And I think the world's starting to wake up to the power of the decentralized technologies of blockchain and cryptocurrency, and Bitcoin in particular. So I'm definitely looking forward to, you know, with everything that's happening geopolitically, you can definitely see a little bit of a shift. Now that the governments are putting a lot of attention and focus, the banks, it's very interesting. So it's very fortunate to be a part of this time of history, a witness.
I think what happened in Canada was like the biggest wake up call to everyone. I think, especially in the, you know, the more modern days. I also remember early on in Bitcoin's history when there was an event in Cyprus that created a massive demand for Bitcoin early on that caused a massive price rise, because the government did go into people's bank accounts and take their money. And
yeah, but that was a smaller event compared to Canada, and didn't get nowhere near the media coverage that Canada got. So I agree with what you're saying. Yeah, and then following that up with all the donations and things that were taking place with Ukraine and stuff.
Yeah. You know, and also no many people who have lived in Latin American countries where there was, you know, crazy runaway inflation, and because of that, you know, governments go bankrupt, and when governments go bankrupt, what they go into people's bank accounts to take half their money. I know personally one person who lived in Brazil, and his family moved here after the government did that for the second time. So they were left with a quarter, where they were first they took half, then took another half, and then you add inflation on top of that, so they're basically left with nothing. And they were like, "That's it, we're out of here. We're moving away from this country." So when inflation runs away, that's what happens. So when I see all this printing happening right now, it's like they still haven't learned a lesson.
No, it's still continuing. The Fed did raise interest rates very, very slightly, you know, very, very minimally. And they're continuing, I believe, their buying of assets. I don't believe that's stopping. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and the inflation that we're experiencing is definitely going to get worse before we even hope or think it's going to get better.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
And a lot of the symptoms of, you know, price inflation like this start to really come alive when you see things coming in, like a price control, where the government says, "Oh, now we set the price for this." What ends up happening at that point is that the shelves go empty, and the black market goes into effect, and the things that people want end up in the back room. And if you want to get them, you can get them for more, not at the price the government set.
Right.
So, and that becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the more they try to price control, the more the black market builds, and so on. And I think we're going to see some of that in the future.
That's an interesting way of looking at things. And, you know, I mean, you have an interesting perspective. I mean, obviously, with this background, I mean, how do you go from molecular biology to mining and trading cryptocurrency?
It's very interesting. Well, first you go from molecular biology to music. That was the first thing. And when you look at how DNA works in the body, it works in basically a pattern of 64 different codons. That's the number 64 in there for you in molecular biology, which is the base of, you know, everything that happens in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at music, and you look at dance music in particular, you know, as a example that's easier for people to wrap around, kind of like techno, you know, things happening in a 64 beat pattern. You know, and every 64 beats, a major change occurs in that pattern. Usually there's also minor changes of the 16th beats, but essentially the same thing as DNA, but in a musical form. And in charting, with Bitcoin, is almost, or any other assets, also very similar, because it works with fractals, it works with patterns. and you know, the Fibonacci sequence, you know, the 64 is buried in there as a sacred number that also rules those places.
I've learned a lot about numbers and stuff, but the number 64 I haven't heard. I guess that would add up to one in numerology. But what is special about 64 in particular? Yeah. Do you know offhand?
Well, essentially, if you go to have you heard of a guy named Nassim Haramein?
It doesn't sound familiar.
So Nassim Haramein is he's not officially an educated mathematician or physicist, but he works with them as partners to generate these papers. And essentially, he has figured out that the structure of the vacuum being the space in between everything, because the universe is mostly empty space, not actual matter. When you're looking at an atom, it's, you know, basically a nucleus with a bunch of empty space and a tiny electron going around. The structure of that empty space works in a 64 tetrahedron structure that holds reality together. And working with mathematicians and physicists, he actually has come up with alternative solutions to all of Einstein's field equations that match that theory. So it has been proven, and 64 is most definitely a structure that controls reality as we know it.
That's fascinating, man. That's fascinating, and I love learning new things. So you mentioned Fibonacci and fractals in charting and looking at things like Bitcoin. Do you find that to be one of your go-to? Because I know there's a lot of different ways that people analyze, do technical analysis. Some people don't utilize the Fibonacci. Is that one of your main go-tos as far as when it comes to reading charts?
Well, one thing that I'm known for is that I strive to learn every tool available to me. And when you look at my Twitter there, that's I'm usually using one particular indicator on that those charts. It's called EMA flow. We can see the candles, and you have those that purple, the green, and the pink lines, those moving averages that move around.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the tools I use. But, you know, at any given time, I have probably about 35 different Bitcoin charts that I can look at with different tools to give me an idea of, you know, what areas match across different tools to say, yeah, this is probably what's going to happen because of this. And I appreciate having every tool in toolbox available to me. And then I use them all. Some of them I use more than others, but I definitely try to look at every possible perspective available to me before I make a prediction.
That's understandable. Now, the numbers that I'm seeing here above the candles, is this something similar to the way Tone Vase does some of his charting?
Yeah, actually, interesting. Tone Vase was a person that that inspired me to get into his indicator. It's called TD Sequential, TD by Tom DeMarc.
Mm-hmm.
Tom DeMarc being one of the giants of technical analysis in the world of finance.
Right.
Also, that's that like I follow very closely, and I studied the DeMarc sequential. And to simplify for most people, when you look at that, what you're seeing is a pattern. You know, this is a bullish pattern going up, and you see the number one at the bottom over there, working away all the way up to a nine. And the nine is the completion of that pattern, and then now it's working its way up to a second nine, where things are getting pretty overheated on that chart I posted there. We're currently on an eight. You know, going into a nine probably tomorrow. So that could be some other sort of top or close to a top before it has a little dip, and then we'll reassess and see where it's going to go. So that's a timing indicator that helps us time things.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Now, just for the sake of people watching this, we are recording on March the 30th, and today is Wednesday. Today's mm-hmm. Wednesday. Yeah. I've got a lot going on this week, and I'm heading out to Miami next week. This video will be released publicly more than likely Saturday, just so everybody knows. So most of the information that we share, we're going to try to make sure we're not talking about what's going to happen between now and then Saturday.
Yeah. But on that specific Twitter post, if you just look at it, you can see that I'm basically saying, hey, things are starting to look pretty overheated over here. You know, a dip's probably in order, but it still looks strong. It'll continue going up after the dip. But the idea is, you know, buy the fucking bit of support and then ride a way for the next level up. And if you decide to be smart and look at the chart closely, you can see the support levels are listed on the right side below for anybody to look at and use that as, like, you know, some buy levels.
All these different prices right here.
Yeah. So you see the pink line there is, you know, one support, and you have the purple line being another support and the green line being the other support. So those, you know, areas of interest for you to add to your position.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very cool. All right. Well, I guess what I will do, and you know, this is going to be on your right here. This is right on your Twitter account. So if people want to follow you on Twitter, again, it'll be linked down below, but it's at TCVMRA. So the crypto vigilante, Mr. A, TCVMRA. You can follow him on Twitter. And I guess what I'll do right now is let you take over with the screen share. And I'll add your screen back here. So if you want to share any charts or anything, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you about the markets is there's a lot of talk about where we are in cycles, whether it's lengthening cycles, super cycles. And then we got this argument of, are we still in a bear market? Are we in a bull market? Is there just these little small bear periods? And then a bear market, a small bear period, kind of like what we experienced last year. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Actually, there's a couple of questions in there that are of interest, of things that you mentioned. And the first one, I'm going to talk about my perspective as an analyst. And through my analysis journey over the years, I figure out that calculating price targets became actually pretty simple. We know it's going there, you know, whether it's going to the bottom.
The number go up, right?
You know, we know it's going to go, if it's going on a trend down, we'll probably go to that place. If it's going to trend up, we'll probably go to that place. And, you know, those are easy to figure out, the number. The question is timing. How do you time things? Is it going to take, you know, a month? Is it going to take 6 months? You know, is it going to happen the next few hours, depending on the time frame you're looking at? How can you figure out the timing for these things and the way they're going to get there? So going back to the chart that we showed earlier, you know, I was talking about Tom DeMark, TD Sequential. Well, those 9 patterns help you calculate time. You know, we are early on a trend. We're in a green 2 going towards a green 9. It's, you know, a 9-day candle pattern on the daily. So you can probably look for a top around that price, around that time. As we get close to that 9 over here, we're probably close to a top, right? And it kind of fits the picture, you know, that I was looking for around, you know, 48 to 50,000. And we hit 48 and now it's getting overheated. So a little dip is in order. So once you get to a complete 9 pattern that there is a top, we'd be looking for, you know, a 1-4 candle correction before continuation if the trend is truly bullish. So in the next, you know, 1-4 candles, well, 1-5 candles, because we're still on an 8, that's what we'll be looking for, timing to figure out where this is going. So that's on the daily chart. Now, this is applicable on the weekly chart. It's applicable on the monthly chart. And I will show that on my own charts where we are on these counts to figure out what is going on with timing as far as that goes. And I think the weekly will be a very clear picture of where we're headed, and then we can reassess from there. So that's the first question, is timing. The second one, you asked me about cycles. And cycles are something that I got into over the past couple of years, because we all know the Bitcoin 4-year cycle. Okay, that's the one that's the most talked about. Mm-hmm. That's the one that everyone is mentioning all the time. And did we top out the 4-year cycle, you know, in November? Yes or no? I don't know what's going on. The cycle is lengthening. I don't think they're lengthening. I still think the Bitcoin makes lows every 4 years. Okay, the lows happening in 4 years. Now, does the low have to be 80% down from the top every time? Probably not, because the previous tops we had this insane parabolic vertical run, you know, in 2013 to 1200, and then 2017 20,000, that went vertical for massive gains, and it became so unreasonable that we had, you know, the 75 to 80% correction after a parabola, which is, you know, a classical charting thing that's expected. You know, we made a parabola, we're going to correct 80%, normal. Now, this time, this cycle, did we really go vertical into a mania phase? And we didn't. We kind of went to a 65, then we dipped 50%, and then we went to 69, we dipped 50%, and we're going up again. And we have a 4-year cycle low coming up in December, so that's going to be pulling price down. Does it have to go down to 20,000, 10,000, you know, 80% down? I don't think so, because we haven't gone vertical.
Okay.
We haven't gone vertical, so I don't see any reason why it should do that. It doesn't have to. There's been no exuberance of like mania and sentiment like that to require a correction of the magnitude. And I think that's where we've been caught in this area between, you know, 30 to 60 for, you know, a year now.
So are you seeing 30 as kind of the bottom? Do you see us potentially having the, like, within the next year going down below?
I think 30 is the bottom of this range right now.
Okay.
And as we get closer to, you know, the 4-year cycle low, then we're going to be attracted back to the bottom. Is that going to hold or not? I don't know. I couldn't tell you that. All I can say is that, you know, at the end of the year this year, there'll be, you know, a cycle that is magnetizing price towards the downside around the end of the year. That's what I can say from the 4-year cycle perspective.
Okay.
As far as referencing, you know, people who are really into explaining cycles really well, I think Bob Lucas is one of the most well-known cycle analysts out there. And
I'm actually not familiar with Bob Lucas. Is he a crypto gentleman or is he into markets in general?
Both, but definitely into crypto. Bob Lucas is a cycles guy that has tracked the 4-year cycle really well. He has a series of videos called the 4-year cycle journey that's free to everyone. And when the last cycle bottom happened, he's basically able to get in at 3,000. And he was helping people with their portfolios on the way up. And he took some off the table at 28, and he took some off the table at 43.8. And just to get all their everyone's money back from their initial investment, and now he's riding the rest of it accordingly to this 4-year cycle plan. So you can find him out there on I think he's on YouTube for free. But okay. He also tracked other cycles. I know as an analyst, I follow him closely. He tracks a 40-week Bitcoin cycle that exists that most people don't know about. And the most important one to me that I use a lot these days now is the 60-day Bitcoin cycle. And that one really, really helps gauge where things are going, in particular within those, you know, 6 days, about 2 months. And that's a round figure. I'm not saying things happen exactly at 60 days, but it's a range of time that lets you figure out, you know, where things are going and what's the trend and when is this trend looking exhausted by time.
Okay.
And now, I will demonstrate that on my 60-day cycle chart just so everyone has an idea of what I'm talking about.
Okay, and I got your screen pulled up. Real quick, when we're looking at what's happening all around the world economically, you know, we're at the end of a fiat cycle, our monetary system. This has been predicted. Now we've just seen another inversion in our yield curve. We had one in 2019. These are all signaling recessions. We see all the money printing going on. We've got war happening. How much of an effect is that going to have on changing these market cycles? That's kind of why I was asking, like, about a super cycle type situation, because this is kind of what Bitcoin was specifically built for, from my comprehension. You know, to replace the fiat system that has kept us all slaves.
Yeah, I think that the old system is going to hang on longer than we expect. I think it will try to grasp itself to the very end. So when people say, well, the dollar will be dead in 2 years. Well, I don't think the dollar will be dead in 2 years. But the dollar is dying, and it's going to be probably a longer process than most people expect. And thankfully, we have Bitcoin as the backup system to hold things together and as a society as things fall apart. So how's that gonna apply to a super cycle in Bitcoin? I don't know. I still think Bitcoin is a very early asset that's just started to mature. And as such, it's still prone to mania phases. And if we do get a mania phase and go vertical, to $150,000 in 3 months, we're going to get the 80% correction, and it's going to be a crash, and it's not going to go up forever. This notion that there's up only from here and it's a super cycle, you know, maybe the direction is up only, but there's going to be some serious downs if we get a mania phase.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Do you see in your outlook for 2022, do you see Bitcoin hitting 100K?
How about we get into the charts and I'll actually get into that and talk about it.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. So like I said, your screen is pulled up. So whatever you want to share.
Okay. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the weekly chart over here. This is a weekly chart that I use for TCV.
Okay.
And I'm going to magnify really big so everyone can see it well.
I'm going to pull it up full screen.
Yeah. And you can see here, you know, it's on the mark count. We basically had a bottom on the one here. This green one became a bottom. We've been moving up for the past 3 weeks now. Well, 2.5 weeks. We're only on Wednesday right now since this bottom up here. So we have 1, 2, 3. You know, what should we expect? 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You know, that'll be a completed count over the next 6 weeks, which would be a really nice thing to see. You know, is that going to go straight up? No, there's going to be dips along the way, and cycles will help us time that. But on a weekly scale right now, we're bullish. You know, we had this bottom here that has held this line 1, 2, 3, 4 times, and it just simply refused to go before 37.8. And eventually the bears gave up, and now we're going up. We've broken up above these moving averages. We're above the middle of the Bollinger Band, which is this indicator over here, headed towards the top of it. And that's around 57K and coming down. So as we move up, this target is going to come down. And when we hit it, we have some sort of top coming up. So that's what I'm looking at on the weekly scale. So in the next few weeks, we're going to have this sort of move. Now, when you look at the greater picture here.
What's interesting is the fact that we've kind of stayed in this kind of 47 range. And not really gone too much below it. We kind of did a little below it today.
Yeah.
But popped right back. 47
range is very important. Look what happened once we topped out on the first top here at a.
Isn't it 48? April last year. 48 is the next resistance.
I will get into that. So we topped out around 65K. And then within a 2 week period, we went all the way down to basically this level. Look at this wick here. And
yeah.
Then we went up, and we finally broke down below it. Look what happened. Boom. Right down. And then we tried again. We're up about a few weeks, dropped below it. Now we're below that wick again. Went down to the bottom, held it, and then pumped. Once we got above that decisively, look what happened. We went all the way up to 68K up here. And then we dropped. We're right at the level. We can see the green line. First touch, went back above it. And then we finally lost it. What do we get? Another visit to the bottom. So this level that we're at right now is very key. And you can see here, it's very key. It's kind of like the mid-range of this whole thing that's been happening. And if we can close above it over the next week or two, then I think a visit to the top is in order. You know, how much of a top? I don't know. 55, 57, you know, even 60 are possible.
Okay.
You know, you can see what happens when you get a move like this. Look at this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And finally topped out on a 7. Which is okay. We don't have to go all the way to 9, but it was telling you here that on a 7, we're getting close to some sort of top because the count's getting exhausted. And sure enough, we got a top and dipped. So right now it's early, you know, and I think, you know, a few more weeks of upside, kind of like in a situation like this, are in order in this part of the cycle. And I'll talk about the cycle. Once, you know, we dip at the end of the next move and what happens after that, then we can talk about what's going to happen next. But I take it one cycle at a time, one level at a time. And I think this is the level here, getting up in the high 50s maybe, and then a nice correction. These corrections tend to be 20 to 30% when we top out. Look at this one over here. That was about 20 to 30%. This one over here does about 30%. Then the bounce failed. See this failure here?
Yeah.
And it went down. So that was the end of the trend, failure, downside. Same thing here, up, down, about 20, 30%. Try to go up, failed, end of trend, here we go. So now we're going to go up. we're going to dip. And when we try again and make a higher high, then we can look at these big numbers up here. But if we fail, then down we go again.
So you're thinking 57 to 60, 57K to 60K?
58 would be the ideal number in my mind.
But, okay. And then maybe a 20% retracement and then kind of making our way back up.
Yeah. 20 to 30 is standard. 20 to 30 is absolutely standard. You know, when even on this one up here, back then that was 31%. Times before that, and they're about that much. They tend to be 20 to 30% corrections. So when we get near an exhausted trend, you probably want to take some off the table and wait a couple weeks and then catch a bottom, because that's a very common thing. That's how these cycles work.
Do you feel like that's where we are now?
Right now, so since we were talking about the weekly, I'm going to jump into my cycle chart over here.
I'm sorry, I'm jumping, you know, kind of back and forth with stuff.
So I'm using my cycle chart over here, and again, I'm referencing Bob Lucas because he introduced me to this concept, and now I make my own charts based on what he does. So there's similarities. They may not be exactly the same. Our numbers may be slightly different. So when I have 57 here, he may have a 60, or I'm calling this the bottom right now. So the bottom for me of that last cycle, which started over here and ended right here, was at day 57 of 60. That was the bottom.
Okay.
And then when we bounced off that bottom, put my little thumbs up here, and we're going up ever since. And sure enough, that's how it's unfolded. So it was at this point here that I pretty much told everyone to be in on Twitter. I say it's probably better to be in than out right now. And there's a lot of people waiting to like catch the one last dip down to the 37s or low 30s. And they're all left waiting because we broke out. And that was the cycle end. And now we're going to go to some sort of top over the next week or two. And like cycle works, there's usually a small dip at the middle of the cycle, which right now I have it over here. It can be higher, it can be lower, it doesn't matter. There'll be a small dip. And then up here, I'm looking at, 58K. That'll be an ideal situation, which would be a higher high than this first top that we get over here. We want to have a proper cycle. You can see this previous one over here.
Mm-hmm.
You can compare the last bottom. And look, it bottomed out on day 61. So we dumped on day 65, went sideways, had an early top over here, dumped in the middle, went sideways, then scared the hell out of everyone down here on day 61, and then reversed right out of it. Boom, all the way to up here, day 33, had a little dip, made a higher high. That was the cycle end, very close to the red zone. So when we get close to these red zones, that's you're going to be out. And what do we get out of that? A 25% correction.
Okay.
So as we get towards the end of this cycle up here, let's say it's 58K. 20% would take us down to 46, which is about here. And a 30% correction would take us down all the way to, 40. So we could see a move from 58 to 40 and then up again.
Yeah, it could happen really quick.
It could happen. And, and these tend to be, if it's a bull market, we call those bullish corrections because they're very fast, very quick to downside with a very fast recovery. Bullish corrections are welcome things in a bull market as opposed to bearish corrections. Bearish corrections are very different. They tend to pump really fast on a downtrend and then continue being down. So kind of like this one here, we went down, had a very fast pump to the top, and then kept bleeding all the way down over here. Then again here, very fast to the top, and then bled all the way down. So, and now we're finally coming out of this. This downtrend is over. We're above it. Now we can look for at least, a few weeks of up, and then we can reassess what happens over here. And that's what I mean by saying I take it one cycle at a time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, I know a lot of times when people make predictions, they are kind of talking out their arse.
Yeah.
There's not really a lot of logic behind it.
But I can give you some logic because you asked me about the six-figure price possibility. So the six-figure price possibility, which is still possible.
Well, I know it's a possibility, but I'm saying a possibility this year by the end of 2022.
And I mean a possibility this year. That's what I'm going to talk about, is that we're going to go to this bottom over here, okay? And what's going to happen is it's going to come out strong because people are going to be so scared shitless at this point, especially going down to 40, okay? Maybe like the bear market's back. We're going to 20. We're going to 10. When that sentiment is in effect, it's going to be the opposite. And we're going to go up like this. And the question is, can we make a higher high than this point here? And if we do, then I think we're going to much higher prices, all-time highs. I think it's totally reasonable, and I think that will put us in a place we could have some sort of a mini parabolic run to 100,000 over the next few months. That could happen. But,
okay,
and there's the but.
The big but.
If we go like to here.
Sir Mix-a-Lot buts.
Very strong. And fail to make a higher high. We're going to roll over. And then go back to the bottom of the range. So that's where I stand. This is bullish right now. It's better to be in than out. It's a great place to be. When we get close to this timing zone, you probably want to be out and protect yourself. Good place to rebuy down here and get in. If it goes up and fails, get out. If it goes up, makes a higher high, stay in.
Now, what kind of time frame are you looking at for the green that you just added as a hypothesis?
So these are 60-day time frames. So the time frame for the next one would be about 60 days. So we'd be expecting some sort of top again.
Well, this kind of makes sense.
Later in the summer, you know, a higher high, you know, maybe even a, you know, 68K or something, or even higher than that. And then another dip. So a lot of people talk about Bitcoin following the lunar cycle. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And there's a reason for that is because it's not an exact science. It's an around 60-day time frame. And we have to figure out what it is by observing the behavior. But that's how I play the timing of the cycles.
Now, from knowing what's going on, like in the next few weeks or so, I find it interesting what you're saying, because usually around April to June-ish, depending on which conference, and in the past it was Consensus, but now it seems to be the Bitcoin conference in Miami that's going to be coming up next week. So There's usually a pump that kind of takes place around then. So it is possible we could get up to that 58K, and then after the conference, during the conference, start seeing a 20 to 30% pullback at that point. And then start going back up and retesting and going back to these other areas that you're talking about.
Yeah. Also, the note is that in bear markets, conferences have no effect whatsoever. I don't think the conferences affect price. I think maybe price affects the conferences by increasing the number of people attending them.
Well, are we in a bear market then? Do you think that we are in a current bear market?
Are we in a bear market? I think there's a possibility, and I'll go back to my weekly chart here, the possibility that we've been in a bear market this whole time since April of last year, and there's a corrective phase that had a weird higher high over here when it tried to go up again and then dumped.
Okay.
So are we in a bear market? I can't answer that. I can't tell you, yes, we're definitely a bear market. We didn't make any lower lows. If I made a lower low over here, I'd be like, we're in a bear market. Confirmed, like, see you at 20,000, maybe 17, and then we'll reassess. But we didn't make a lower low, so it's not a bear market. A lot of people were screaming, double top, M top up here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you might have seen that all over Twitter. This is a top, it's M top. Well, right now, in order for it to be an M top, we had to break down below this level. And we haven't. And now we've made a higher high over here. So it's not an M top anymore. But what is it? I can't tell you yet. I don't know what
right.
it is. It's going to be a head and shoulders that goes up to here and then dumps and like makes, you know, goes to 20,000 by December. It could happen. Then is it a bear market? Yeah, it's a bear market. If it makes a higher high, it's not a bear market.
You said the M top. That's when people were doing the McDonald's memes with the McDonald's.
Yes, you know, the double top thing, you know.
Yeah, that was kind of funny. You know, and the reason I asked about the bear market specifically is because looking at what's going on in the stock markets, the legacy system, which we still are somewhat correlated, I think the powers that be and the people with money know that we're going to be going down in the long term because of what's happening around the world, And I don't know if it's like a squeeze where they're trying to bring prices up so that they can get a good exit point. And I didn't know how much that would affect Bitcoin. And the question of, since we hit the last top of, are we in a bull market still? Are we in a bear market? And that's why I asked about the lengthening cycles, the super cycles, because it's just like we're in this unknown kind of area.
Yeah, I still think there's going to be a cycle low in December, but from where? I don't know. It's going to be from here and then down, or it's going to be from a way higher high and then down. And we'll figure that out on a cycle by cycle basis as we get through these over the next few months.
Now, do you look at, this is do you
very,
look at,
this is a very, so sorry. I was going to say, this is a very different topping behavior than previous bull market tops for Bitcoin. And it has to do with the higher market cap. Now that we're, you know, playing around the 1 trillion market cap, which is, you know, at 55,000 Bitcoin's a trillion. So we've been playing around that zone up below it. So once 55,000 is solidified, we'll be at 1 trillion all the time. And we have to look for things to unfold differently than it did before, because it's a more mature asset, and that's what happens to them.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, when you're looking at Bitcoin, do you look at things like Ethereum, and do you look at other cryptocurrencies that you're, or are you pretty much like focused on privacy related coins like Monero, Pirate Chain?
I look at a whole bunch of different things. You can see on my list here on the side, I have a lot of different coins I look at. It's not just Bitcoin. I also look at traditional markets too. But Bitcoin is the reserve asset of the cryptocurrency market, mm-hmm. and it's the most important, and it's the tide that lifts or sinks all boats. With exceptions, there's exceptions here and there every so often, but generally speaking, that's the most important asset to be looking at, and then things tend to follow it or not follow it sometimes, but generally speaking, there's a trend that goes with it.
Right. I asked because there's been some question whether or not Ethereum would hit 10K before Bitcoin hits 100K, and because they have, there's some interesting things that are happening with Ethereum over the next few months that, you know, could potentially lead into that. And then there's also all the talk of flipping market cap.
In fact, when people start talking about flipping market cap all the time, very like during a bull run, when that talk comes in, to me, that's a topping signal. The flip things here, I'm like, sell, get out, just like sell.
That's a good one.
You know, that's the way I look at it. In 2017, it was the same thing. Ethereum is going to flip, and it's going to flip, and like that was the end. Now Ethereum is a project that you know, it does what it does. It has changed its financial system many times, basically on all the whims of one dude, which is I don't like that. First, it was a limited supply coin. Then it became a limited supply coin, and now it's going to be a staked coin, and it's going to be a burning supply coin, which it already is. And I think because of their burning supply, it's just great amounts, is the reason why it's performing better than Bitcoin right now. You can see the Ethereum to Bitcoin ratios are rising. Is that going to lead to a flipping? I don't know. I can't tell you that. I do find it humorous that the same Ethereum people who said the flip mining's coming back in 2017, Bitcoin fees are too expensive, you know, they're freaking out over it. They're like $20, $40 are the same people that pay, you know, $100, $200 gas fees to move their assets over this chain. So
yeah,
there's some humor in that, the irony.
Yeah, definitely. And since you mentioned a little bit about like even the push to proof of stake with Ethereum, there was news just came out, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, about someone from Ripple, Chris Garland, I don't know if that's the right name or not, is pushing to change the Bitcoin code to make Bitcoin proof of stake. Have you heard this?
I saw that. It's just funny and lame and pathetic. Because the proof of work is what truly gives these digital assets real value. And proof of stake is a big part of many scams, because you know it benefits the early adopters or the pre miners that, you know, pre mine a whole bunch of the stuff, and then they make money off staking all these assets. So I think it's really funny that the Ripple scammer is trying to push for Bitcoin to become kind of a scam as well.
Yeah, no, it's it's a little ironic. And, you know, when you think about the Bitcoin mining too, I mean, there's been recent news where Exxon is going to be using natural gas, something that they're going to be doing, getting involved in Bitcoin mining. So there's all this improvement for energy, better energy, cleaner energy, renewable energy. Someone is taking excess stuff and turning in what would be waste into something that can be utilized for energy to mine Bitcoin. So the argument is a crazy argument, but I just thought it was funny that they're even trying to propose making Bitcoin a proof of stake coin. That just kind of goes against everything the white paper talked about.
Of course. And energy, Bitcoin's an energy storage system when you look at it in a way, because to mine a Bitcoin, there's a cost in energy, electricity, the cost in equipment, so the capital expense to mine it, and then all the energy stored in the form of Bitcoin, which can then be transferred across time to a future point in time where you can spend the energy, you know, and rebuy sort of energy to fuel something else or turn it into a good or a product or transfer your wealth to the next generation. And I think that's a very important part of it, is to what gives it. People in the old financial world always ask, what gives Bitcoin its value? I'm like, well, the fact that you have to spend, you know, five figures right now to mine a single coin, it gives value because there's a capital expense to make it happen.
But on the flip side, what gives fiat money any value when Richard Nixon basically not only took the United States up, but the rest of the world off of any particular gold standard, which wasn't backed one for one, very much like Tether. But
no, it's backed by debt.
Yeah, no, it is. But actually, yeah. It's funny you brought up energy, because really everything, our monetary system is based off our energy. So the debt's based off our future performance of energy. Mm-hmm. So it's all equating back to energy. Yeah. So, yeah.
But what is energy but time spent? Time being the most precious resource in the universe.
Right. It's a way of valuing our worth for labor or whatever. That's one of the reasons why we came up with these monetary systems.
Yeah. And when they print more, they're stealing your energy, they're stealing your time, and stealing your life. And that is a crime against humanity, in my opinion.
It is. And it's also what a lot of people, even Jeff Berwick included, would say is a hidden tax. So an additional tax upon the taxes that you're already being taxed.
Mm-hmm. So it's silent theft.
Yeah, so people are already working, like in the United States, for example, people are working on average a third of their year for taxes. So a mm-hmm. third of their year goes straight to government, which is, you know, very unfortunate when you think about things like that. And you start studying history, the founding fathers, the Constitution, what was and wasn't supposed to be, and where we are now. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's another discussion.
It is.
Now, besides Bitcoin, you know, I know that you're a fan of Monero and Pirate Chain. Do you find that privacy coins are going to be having a lot of problems when it comes to regulatory issues that are going to be coming from not only the United States, but other governments?
Mm-hmm. So here's a stand on it. So let's look first is like, what is the number one privacy coin in the world right now? That's not a cryptocurrency. It's called physical cash.
True.
Okay. Physical cash is a privacy coin. And the system has been built in such a way that people can still interact with it. But if they have to turn their cash into, you know, real world things, you know, by using other systems, they've been able to do that. Privacy coins are the same form of thing, but in the crypto universe. And when exchanges say we're delisting privacy coins because we can't trust them and regulations and all the crap they mention about it, well, let's look at one exchange, for example, and let's talk about Kraken. And Kraken has Monero. Kraken is also a bank. And if a bank / crypto exchange can handle Monero in a regulatory environment in the United States, why can't other exchanges do the same? It makes no sense to me. So I think that when delistings happening and all that stuff happening. I think it's just it's a bunch of, you know, FUD, and there's no reason for it to for them not to exist.
Now, Zcash is listed on a lot of different exchanges. I believe it's on Coinbase, if I'm not mistaken.
It's been Gemini. Delisted.
It's been delisted?
Yeah, I believe it's been delisted.
What about from delisted? Gemini?
I don't know about Gemini, but...
But is Zcash truly a privacy coin?
No, I think it's a privacy shitcoin because it's not privacy by default. And when you have a blockchain that only a fraction of a percent of people are using the privacy feature, it makes no sense because chain analysis is still possible on all the other transactions. So you're not figuring out who the person who used privacy was. It makes me more of a suspect.
So in order to have the privacy features using Zcash, you have to choose to use the privacy features. Otherwise, by default, it just acts as a regular transparent blockchain. Exactly.
Yeah, and also exchanges that do have it and having delisted only accept the unprivate transactions. So if you send like, I remember when Coinbase had it in their exchange, if you sent a private Zcash transaction, it wouldn't work.
That makes sense.
You have to use the transparent because they're trying to meet regulations. But it all comes up to me is like Kraken's a bank. It can handle Monero. Any bank can handle physical cash. So what's the big deal? You know, at the end of the day, if you're going to take your Monero and, you know, buy a house with it, you're still going to have to report that because, you know, how is a real world thing and there's going to be a trail and, you know, the tax man might come after you for taxes owed on that amount they took out. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether it came in Monero or Bitcoin or whatever.
That makes a lot of sense. So do you, have you done a deep dive and researched a bunch of these privacy coins or do you focus more on markets and,
no,
and technical
I've,
analysis?
I mean, my other background is IT security, so I've done a very deep dive in privacy coins. And the ones that matter to me are basically Monero, Parachain, and Darrow now, which I think is a very important coin. And Monero
is kind of
the mean joke.
Darrow is kind of like a private Ethereum?
Darrow is a private Ethereum, but the technology is much more advanced than Ethereum. In fact, I don't know if you know, is that when the idea of Darrow was first mentioned to Vitalik Buterin, you know, 3 years ago, he said, that's not possible. And like, and here are 3 years later, it's been gone live and the idea is fully possible and it's far superior to Ethereum. It's got what Ethereum hopes to be, but can't be because it's been turned to this thing now. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it's much more advanced. I mean, it's as far as technology goes, it's a, you know, very advanced technology above and beyond most things.
And that was a crypto vigilante pick, wasn't it?
Yes, it was early on. Okay. So I think Mr. X recognized that one very early on.
Okay.
And
have you looked into Mimblewimble at all?
Yes, we have all looked at Mimblewimble. We don't believe it's a sound privacy technology. And a lot of Mimblewimble coins, the early ones have been cracked. So I don't really believe in them as a asset that you want to hold.
Well, with that being said, have you looked at or do you even care about the fact that Litecoin has added kind of a sidechain option with the Mimblewimble feature?
Is it going to be private by default?
It's not. No, because I know. And I interviewed Charlie about it. I had him on a couple months ago. Same issue. Like you said, there are exchanges that basically are saying they can't do it because of what they feel is regulatory compliance, but you're giving Kraken as an example that, and Kraken definitely plays ball. They're not one to go against the system. You can't get a banking license if you're not, you know, a ball player.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
at the same time, they stand for people's rights. And when the Canada thing happened, you know, Jesse Powell was the first one to say, get your stuff off the exchange and put it in cold storage.
Yeah, that's smart. No, unless you're actively trading, I definitely wouldn't recommend people to leave their cryptocurrencies on an exchange as a means of storage. Would you recommend that?
No, most definitely not. Definitely not.
Just make sure we're on the same page.
Yeah. And I think there's some exchanges around the world who are using the non-custodial model, and I think it's really, really cool to do that, where if you need to buy Bitcoin, you can buy with, you know, you put your fiat in the exchange, okay? They hold your fiat. When you buy Bitcoin, the Bitcoin gets sent to your cold storage immediately. They never actually hold it. And when you sell Bitcoin, the Bitcoin gets sent to them and they convert dollars immediately and send it to where you need it to go. They never actually hold your dollars. And I think that's a model for the future. that should be used by most exchanges when possible.
That is a cool model.
Yeah, because when you have that model, suddenly all those SEC rules don't apply because you don't have custody. They don't have custody of anything. So then they don't have to follow the same rules, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, if we see regulations start to kind of tighten, you know, there's been suggestion of basically if you want to send your funds to a custodial wallet like Coinbase, you'll have to send your funds from a wallet that has been identified with KYC or it won't accept the transfer.
Yeah, Coinbase has just launched that this week in Canada, Japan, and somewhere
right,
else.
So
if you want to withdraw, you have to like basically say, this is my own wallet.
Yeah, so with all that being said, I mean, I can see where the cypherpunk movement, that libertarian mindset, will stand back up and start building better solutions for us. Because I really feel like crypto has kind of gotten... generally, crypto in general has gotten, it's changed from that mentality of the cypherpunks, the Satoshi Nakamoto's, to where we are today, which is working with the banks, keeping the legacy system relevant, allowing them to incorporate themselves into what this space is about. You see Consensus, you see Vitalik and the relationship he has. Consensus in particular, the whole MetaMask JP Morgan thing. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that fire being relit and start seeing these cypherpunks come back out and other future people who are inspired by the cypherpunk movement to create these solutions that we need, like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important.
Yeah. And going back to, privacy coins and all coins in general, I have to talk about my theory behind them and how I feel about them.
Are you a Bitcoin maximalist?
I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist, but I am a store of value maximalist. I'll get into that right now. So basically, I believe in privacy. If you need a privacy layer, you can use the privacy layer anytime by buying any of these assets and doing what you need to do with them. That's great. But for a long-term hold, okay, I think you want to be holding Bitcoin for sure as part of your portfolio. And in my opinion, you should be holding, you know, at least half in Bitcoin for the long-term. And if you're going to hold all coins, you should be holding things that are going to outperform Bitcoin. And if they're not outperforming Bitcoin, you should not be holding them. You should not be holding them for a 99% correction and say, oh, I still got my privacy, but I lost 99% of my wealth. That does not work for me. A lot of these, you know, shit coins out there, people are still holding them and saying like, oh, I believe in this, but what's the point in holding this if you lost 99% of your money? This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, Bitcoin forks are the prime examples of that. In particularly Bitcoin Cash and BSV, who had like all their believers, and you know, I don't care about any of their ideas or what they think, you know, Bitcoin is, who's Bitcoin, who's the real Bitcoin. I don't care. Like, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is like, what is allowing me to store my wealth for the long term and transfer across generations if need be. And to me, that's Bitcoin, BTC. That's the one that's been proven. The market has decided that's the one. And I don't see any point in holding things that are going to put you at, you know, a loss of wealth only because you have a belief in them. So that's where I stand with altcoins. I think it's okay to hold them in smaller amounts if you want, but you should make Bitcoin the primary part of your portfolio. And when altcoins start to underperform Bitcoin, and if you're in profit and the charts are telling it's going to go down 90%, there's no point in holding them. Just get out and take the money and run.
Take the money and run. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense the way that you're explaining it. And I appreciate you kind of giving your point of view on it. Yeah. Tone Vase, a lot of people called him a Bitcoin maximalist. And he has since kind of taken on a term, shitcoin minimalist, which is kind of like the way you explained it. I would almost put you in that category.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay to trade altcoins to make more Bitcoin or like squeeze some dollars out of it. But don't hold things that are going to put you at a loss in the long term, you know. And that applies to privacy coins too. You look at Monero versus Bitcoin ratio going back to 2017. Has Monero been a better store of value than the Bitcoin? No, absolutely not. Should Monero be like 100% portfolio? Probably not. Not if you want to outperform it. And
Right.
it takes time to figure out which coins will do that with Bitcoin. And Willy Wu was the first person to come up with this these two names. And to him, altcoins are either oscillators or degenerators. Those are the two names for them. And Ethereum is an oscillator because it oscillates with Bitcoin, down and up, but it tends to outperform Bitcoin in the long term. And you can hold it, it's okay, but you can sell the tops and buy the bottoms. And this is kind of like sideways range thing that it does. So it oscillates against Bitcoin. And it's an okay store of value compared to Bitcoin. But it's not a bad store of value where it's going to lose you 90%. Dogecoin is another oscillator, believe it or not. But the rest of almost every altcoin in the world is a degenerator, and it will only lead to 90% losses against Bitcoin. So there's no point in holding them in your portfolio as holds.
It's funny you mentioned Doge, though, because Doge is something like when we talk about people wanting to buy coffee with Bitcoin and you think of Gresham's Law. If you want to utilize cryptocurrency to be able to make your everyday small purchases, I think Dogecoin would be one of the better coins to be utilized because of the fact that it's inflationary. There's no max supply and there's always more Doge coming out. So Gresham's Law would make sense under that kind of, from my understanding. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, it makes sense to me, but I mean, when it comes down to it, let's say you do want to use Bitcoin for your day-to-day purchase, okay? So you're gonna use Dogecoin. So what do you have to do? You have to convert your Bitcoin to Dogecoin and then go to the terminal and pay with Dogecoin. Okay, great. So Dogecoin is kind of like fiat. So if I have a crypto.com credit card and I got my Bitcoin in there, I'm gonna go buy a coffee. I can convert some of my Bitcoin into fiat and then tap my card and buy my coffee. So it's the same model and it's already there and working.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I
Yeah.
guess
So,
unless you're doing this peer to peer, yeah, it makes
yeah. So it's
sense.
like they're kind of reinventing the wheel. So, to me, like, what's the future? Well, the future will be, okay, everyone's running a Lightning wallet, and then you need a little bit of Bitcoin to load up your Lightning wallet. Okay, great, you converted it, and then you go to your coffee terminal and tap it, and then there it is. And then you just skip the whole conversion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you need to do to make it happen.
What are your feelings on the Lightning Network?
Well, I think the Lightning Network is doing exactly supposed to be doing. And the capacity of it is growing every day, and actually been growing quite a lot over the past year. So I think it's good. I think it's doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay. Now, aside from Bitcoin and privacy coins, which, would be like your Dero that we mentioned, Pirate Chain, Monero. Are there any other cryptocurrencies, any other altcoins, shitcoins that you find validity in that you personally are invested in or that you find has longevity?
First and foremost, one of the ones that I had been keeping my eye on for a while was it was named Loki, and it was renamed as Oxen, and it's the back end of something called Session Messenger Protocol, which is a blockchain-based private messenger. So it's in a way it's better than Signal because it's decentralized, but it gives you probably even better privacy than Signal.
Yeah, just
But it's harder. It's
downloaded
harder
that
to use.
app.
It's harder to use because you can't use your phone number to sign up. So getting mom and pop to get a session messenger account with a massive private key they have to enter into is it more complex. So people don't do that. But in a shit the fan scenario where you need decentralization, that's a it's a better messenger. And the Oxen tokens are the staking mechanism by which session messenger works. So it's a
Okay.
very good coin to get into, and just started to rise in value this week. So it's a
So
nice one to be getting
listen
into.
to this. I downloaded the application probably like a week ago. I haven't like set up an account, but it says on the application when you first bring it up, your session begins here. using a combination of advanced anonymous routing and end-to-end encryption technologies. And this is the cool part. Friends, don't let friends use compromised messengers. You're welcome.
Yep.
So you feel like Session is a more privacy oriented messaging service than something like Telegram?
Oh, I mean, it's leaps and bounds above Telegram without question, because nothing's stored in any server and not visible by anyone. And it's superior to Signal. Even though Signal is a very excellent private messenger, it's still centralized with US-based servers. So yeah, there's a weak point in there.
I meant to say Signal, not Telegram. So thank you for adding that in. Appreciate teamwork.
So but when you set up Session, what's going to happen is you're going to have to get a private key, and you have to back up your private key, just like you do with any other cryptocurrency that you're going to cold store.
Okay.
So I think that's a bit of a block for a lot of people, because they don't like to manage their own private keys and have a backup, you know, written a piece of paper somewhere in case you lose your phone and you want to restart your Session app. You're going to need that to restart your Session app.
Right.
Yeah.
So aside from, you said, no, the token used to be called Loki, and it's called what?
It's called Oxen now. O-X-E-N.
Okay. Aside from Oxen, is there any other altcoins that you're looking at or that you're interested in?
I'm interested in. So that was the first one that I mentioned. I do like having a little bits of other plays all over the place. You know, for example, especially in a DeFi and NFT space. For example, Mana and Sand, Avalanche, Luna, Sol. I think all those are good projects. Would I hold them for the long term forever, like I would Bitcoin? No, you know, it's a, if I think they're going to underperform Bitcoin and put me in a loss, I'm not going to hold them forever. So I just think they're good projects to be in. So that's what I feel about that. I also like ENJ a lot. That's an early ENJ engine. Yeah, totally.
It's okay.
It kind of went really crazy from low prices when it was legalized in Japan as something that is to be used by a lot of different companies as like an in-game currency.
Okay.
But it also has an NFT and metaverse capabilities, kind of like an all-in-one kind of thing. So,
no, I like their NFTs. I think that there's a lot more creativity in their NFTs than with Ethereum. And then you could actually back the NFTs up with tokens, so you could burn the NFT and get engine tokens.
Yeah. And when they first launched, they were an Ethereum-based token, and they actually had Ethereum implement another protocol. I mean, most tokens are ERC-20s. But ENJ had Ethereum itself implement another ERC protocol for engine.
Was it 7155?
Yeah, 7155. So,
can't believe I remembered that.
Yeah, it's an important protocol because it works different than ERC-20. So it's more suited towards doing what it does. So I thought that was pretty cool that they managed to get their own thing implemented into Ethereum to make it happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you had mentioned Pirate Chain. And I had asked Raphael about this as well, and a few other people that are big Pirate Chain fans. So are to the pirates, but to me, it's just a private version of Komodo. Have you looked into Komodo itself? And if you have, what are your thoughts on Komodo?
I've looked at Komodo. We have to remember a Pirate Chain. It's not just a Pirate Chain blockchain that is a copy of Komodo. Pirate Chain is a default privacy first network, and blocks are mined but also time stamped on Komodo and Litecoin. So in order to hack a block on Pirate Chain, you gotta have a 51% attack on Pirate Chain and Komodo and Litecoin all at the same time.
They changed that. Yeah, because it was originally Bitcoin that they were piggybacking off of.
Yeah.
And then they I guess for transaction fees, they moved over to the Litecoin blockchain.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense to me. It's, you know, a lighter thing that you want to have as your on your back end. It makes sense to me. I think it's a good move. I have looked at Komodo as well, which is I think it's partially why they used it as the part of their whole project to do things with. And you know, Parachain is basically Zcash with default privacy on
Okay,
top of
that
it all.
makes sense.
So it's default private, it's default Zcash with privacy on. It's you know, time stamping into other blockchains. It's a very advanced cryptography. So it's a great coin. It has outperformed Bitcoin over the past couple of years since launch. It's a pretty high supply, so we'll see how that continues. I don't know yet, but I think it's got so much higher prices coming. So, you know, if you bought a dollar or below a dollar, or even right now a couple bucks, it's going to be a good place to be in. It's been as high as 16, and then once it gets up to 16, it will have higher prices from there. So, we'll figure it out. Now, the thing I was talking about degenerators as well, degenerator coins, is that we can't figure out what is a degenerator coin or a oscillator coin until it's had a, you know, a good 4 year cycle against Bitcoin. Parachain's still early on, and in the early phase, any new altcoin should outperform Bitcoin. When Bitcoin has a true bear market, then we'll see whether all these projects can hold their own and then come out of the bear market and oscillate, or if they're going to keep degenerating and go into oblivion like all other shitcoins.
Going to the shitcoin oblivion, that would be like that would basically be the toilet, wouldn't
I mean, it's below the toilet, down the pipe.
it? Below the toilet, that would be a good name for a podcast. Below the toilet with Mr. A.
That's where I stand with it. I think for now, Parachain is an early project, and it's a good time to be in, and look for it to outperform Bitcoin over the next you know, couple of years, and then we'll reassess and see where it's at.
Cool, man. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And, you know, I definitely want to, you know, be able to have more conversations with you because I thoroughly enjoyed this. And one of the things that we had talked about before recording, you sent me an article last night that I was looking at. I'll pull it up here in a minute. Again, what we're talking about, everything is going to be linked in the video description. But the one thing that I'm going to let people know about what I'm going to share, and let me go ahead and add this back up. Because this is the first question I had to ask. Because he sent me this article. Mr. A sends me this article. I know who Satoshi is. Says, if you want to talk about this, we can talk about it. And since he's anonymous, I'm like, did he just dox himself to me? So this is not Mr. A. This guy right here, Gerald Vada. He works for quantum economics with Madi Greenspan. Madi's been on the show a couple times. For whatever reason, this guy has me blocked on Twitter. Not really sure why, but he has blocked me on Twitter. But he wrote this article talking about I know who Satoshi Nakamoto is, and he gives a really good explanation about a guy. What is his name?
James A. Donald.
James A. Donald. And based off of this article, do you feel that there's not only validity, but maybe that is who Satoshi is?
So I'm gonna go back to the beginning. So at the beginning of this conversation, we talked about the fact that, you know, I was able to witness Satoshi posts early on in real time. Also witness, you know, his writing style, the vibe behind the way he writes, the calmness and the coolness of how he executed things and how he approached things, was very notable. And the way that he wrote was, you know, everyone talks about it being in British English, you know, using words that in regular English ends in OR, like favor, but in British English it's OUR. So that's something notable in his writing style. And many people talk about being him being like a British person living in America. And what's well known about Satoshi too is that he tended to post his you know, his circadian rhythm was to post in a West Coast of North America time zone hours. And since the beginning, I always thought, well, that's interesting. People are thinking he's like, you know, a British person living in America on the West Coast. Which is not a lot of people when it comes down to, you know, British people living in America on the West Coast, but there's a lot of Canadian people living on the West Coast, and they all write like that. So that instantly made me think about, well, maybe he's a Canadian, and that's why he writes like that, and that's why his time zone is what it is, which made more sense in my mind. And then when I read this article that we were talking about, it's talking about, James A. Donald being another cryptographer, also anonymous, but known to be a Canadian, who basically was the first person to respond to Satoshi's email to the cryptography list, where he said, mentioned Bitcoin and the white paper, and who replied to it really quickly. He replied within 3 minutes of getting it, and replied very intelligent questions that probably go above and beyond reading a white paper in 3 minutes. So that's what he's talking about the article, that James A. Donald was probably Satoshi himself, and he replied to the email with those questions to get the conversation moving.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, is you think about how meticulous Satoshi was as an individual or potentially a group at being anonymous and not being revealed. It doesn't make sense that he would do something like that so quickly. You know, I would even think, like, even myself, I would think that maybe it's too soon. Maybe I should wait like an hour. Hour and a half, 2 hours after this post, and then go in there and, you know, because then it does look like you've had time to read and kind of get an understanding of the depth of what this white paper was supposed to be. But the rest of the evidence is pretty wild. Like that e-check website.
So basically, James built a model, many years before that, called e-check, and check spelt in the Canadian way with a Q-U-E, which is essentially an early version of a Bitcoin-like messaging system, which is very similar to Bitcoin. And when you look at it and how early it was made and the language around it, it's very similar to Satoshi. Even the intention behind it seems similar to Satoshi. Satoshi, when he first mined the initial Genesis block, put the message about the Chancellor bailout to banks. So he's immediately saying, it's probably supposed to be a form of solid money. The white paper itself is peer-to-peer electronic cash in the title. And this e-check project that he had is also, a better form of money in messaging. And when he mixed the e-check project with, Hashcash and a couple other things, you essentially have Bitcoin. So I thought it was a really interesting article that shows an early version of something that is very similar and coming from someone who's also anonymous, who writes in a very similar way and says very similar things like Chomian and so on.
Yeah, but you mentioned the Chomian thing because I've talked a lot about David Chom, who people call the godfather of cryptography, and basically in an early 80s dissertation paper wrote all but one element of what became the Bitcoin blockchain. And this is even before we had internet available publicly, which is fascinating. But one of the things that I was curious about looking at this e-check website, what is Kong? Is that the language or the protocol that eCheck runs off of?
I believe that is what he put there, but also when he mentioned Kong, he was also referring to a form of preventing government oppression in Hong Kong. So that's partially why he used that name to do that.
Yeah, I read that in the beginning of it. And it says it's a software program that uses elliptical curve cryptography to sign documents electronically. And then if you go, and again, this will be linked, but if you go to the eCheck website, which is still available, but it says the software is no longer supported and has not been updated in some time, you can go through and read the
2001 or
verbiage.
so, it's still running.
So this was in 2001 that this came out.
Yeah, I think so. It was very, very early 2000s. So, very early form of Bitcoin.
And it's kind of neat how they were paying homage to Hong Kong. And then it was also mentioned that Hong Kong, and this has been one of the issues with some of the stuff going on in Hong Kong, is the fact that it's technically a British territory and it's supposed to be given back to China at a certain point of time. And I don't think we've reached that time period.
At that time, not yet. It was actually just starting, and something to know is that Hong Kong English is the kind of English we're talking about, British English, And a lot of Hong Kong people were relocated to the west coast of Canada shortly before the return to China was done. So maybe this person, James A. Donnell, was one of those people.
Well, when me and you were talking before we started recording, and I'm sure this is the question that a lot of people are curious about, but where the hell is James A. Donnell?
He disappeared the same time as Satoshi. That was the other interesting part, that he stopped posting to the mailing list at the same time Satoshi disappeared.
And then what's crazy about that is, you know, obviously there was this article written in Medium, and then there was a follow-up done by Cointelegraph, which is the first or second largest crypto publication media outlet, which means that other smaller outlets probably covered it as well. So it got a lot of coverage. I haven't heard about it, but I'm sure people have hunted for this guy. If anybody knows James A. Donald, or if James A. Donald is watching this, I would love to interview you, Mr. Donald.
Yeah,
or should I call you James Satoshi?
Yeah.
It's a good argument. I mean, me and you talked as much of a fan as, and I mentioned this with the Rafael Liberté interview, but which will also be linked down below, which is also on the Crypto Vigilante YouTube channel. As much of a fan as I am, as I'm not of Craig Wright as an individual because of his actions, not as an individual people, I kind of felt like after doing some research, looking into some other people's work, some other people's ideas, some other people's research, that Craig was a part of the team and wrote the white paper. But I hadn't heard this argument because there is a lot of similarity in a sense because of the fact that Australia was a British territory, or is a British territory too. So there's a lot of similarity in what you would see in the UK, in Canada,
yeah,
Australia, even New Zealand included, and maybe even Hong Kong, like you said. So
yeah, but the one thing we have to know is that Craig was in the wrong time zone for posting Satoshi was posting on those forums. Complete opposite.
But you could hide all that and obscure it, couldn't you?
Well, no, you don't. How do you obscure your sleep cycle? You're going to sleep at certain times and be up at certain other times, right? It's
Which is why some people thought it was more than one individual.
Yeah. I don't believe it was more than one individual. I believe it was one person, a very smart person. And I think the argument that James and Satoshi are the same person is actually pretty high probability.
So what are your chances that you think that James A. Donald is the one and only single individual known as Satoshi?
I mean, at this point, we can probably give it a 50-50 chance, in my opinion, because there's some very notable things that are so similar.
Any other candidates that you've considered?
I don't have any other candidates, but one thing I want to mention is that on the white paper, the e-check project was not referenced, and I think that was on purpose to actually obscure the identity further. Only Hashcash was mentioned and a few other things, but the e-check was totally left blank out of the source material.
Is the code still available where somebody could review the e-check code versus the Bitcoin code, out of curiosity?
I haven't actually looked into that.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there is similarities obviously in it, but I mean, it's possible that James A. Donald could have been a rival cryptographer, and maybe Satoshi did not want to reference it to not give any attention to this individual. Who knows? I try to think outside the box as much as possible. There is that dude, LaRouche or something, who's in prison. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not. But one thing I remember Satoshi on the forums, he was a very collaboration-oriented individual. He wanted to collaborate and make it better rather than having rivalries between people.
That's a good point. And you would know better than I, because you were involved in these forums and Did you actually have any communication with Satoshi?
I never personally messaged him directly, but I definitely watched things unfold in the public forum post.
What year was that?
That was early, 2010 to 2012, I believe.
You didn't start mining until like 2012?
I started mining shortly before that, and then into the ASIC revolution 2013, and then by 2014 I was shutting down.
Just out of curiosity, and it's just me being nosy, do you have any of those old Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure.
sweet, because I know like there is a nostalgia, I guess, for owning Bitcoin that would be traced back to the early days. That's got a long history.
That's been mostly unspent for a whole decade until very recently.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, man, I really appreciate you sharing. Was there, one more thing that I wanted to add, and I'll send you a video for this. I do watch Chico Crypto periodically, and he's got I don't know if he still works with this individual, but he had a guy helping out with research. And he's done some videos, series of videos about Elon Musk being a candidate.
I don't think Elon Musk is a candidate, to be honest. I don't think he has the personality or focus to create mathematics of that degree to be a candidate, to be Satoshi. Yeah, he's off the list, man.
Well, I get that, and I respect your opinion on that, but it's, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but it's really interesting, the argument that he puts up, because, I mean, Elon is a coder, and he's very proficient in C++ and things to that effect. So there's a lot of interesting things that I think is pretty interesting that people should take note of.
Mm-hmm. And the white paper itself is so elegant, and there's a simplicity in the complexity of it as well that is notable. And also we have to consider that, you know, it is such a beautiful thing that it's practically alien technology in a way.
You know, well, one thing I can appreciate that you said, man, is talking about simplicity of things. Because when looking at your resume and having a conversation with you, I can't see how you can look at things in a simple way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. No, I definitely look at every level of the system that I'm looking at, from the micro to the macro. And aim to understand it, but there's simplicity in that too.
Well, this has been beautiful, man. Like I said, I thoroughly enjoyed it. We definitely have to do it again in the future. And before we do wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or anything that you want to add?
Any final thoughts? No, I think I'm good. We covered a lot of ground today, and we'll leave further thoughts for future endeavors.
That sounds good, man. I do appreciate it. And what I will do real quick is I want to add up to the screen, pull up this information. So we have Mr. A's Twitter account. We have Crypto Vigilante. You can sign up, become a member of the Crypto Vigilante. They also have free summits, some free workshops. I know they got a Bitcoin crypto education course. Mm-hmm. So you can check that out. Check out their blog section. I'll also have links for their Twitter as well for Crypto Vigilante, and I'll have that Rafael Laverde interview. I also include this article from Medium about who is Satoshi. I know who Satoshi Nakamoto is, this article from Cointelegraph, and then also the eCheck website, which, you know, I encourage people to check out and read and do some comparative research.
Yeah, one thing I can mention is that on that workshop you just showed there for that was coming up.
Let me go back to it.
One thing that I will be doing with Mr. W is that we'll be showing everyone how to do charting from the most basic level to get you charting nicely as a first lesson to get you going, which is something we didn't have when we started. We didn't even have these tools back then. we didn't have TradingView and Bitcoin and like all these indicators, all the other things to do it back in 2010, 2011. And now we do. So it will help you get ahead in your charting and your trading if you take that workshop. So I highly recommend that you join it and learn lots from it.
And it's the Crypto Basics Workshop, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, cool. Yeah, me and Raphael talked about that, and I will definitely include a link for that so people can register, and it's completely free. So, and then if you like what you're seeing and you like the kind of analysis that you're getting from Mr. A here, and you like the conversation I had with Raphael, I would definitely encourage you to sign up for the Crypto Vigilante. And if you even want to take it a step further, you can sign up for the Dollar Vigilante too. So if you could bear with me 1 second, Mr. A, I'm just going to wrap up and stop recording. So again, ladies and gentlemen, I do appreciate you tuning in. Check out the links down below. Make sure you're following Mr. A on Twitter and checking out the Crypto Vigilante. If this is your first time ever watching any of my videos, be sure to check out and explore my channel. Make sure you subscribe, hit the notification bell, and I will leave you with this. Be blessed, be the change, practice change.